Today is Saturday, November 21, 2020. This is a Part 7 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Carl Bowman, spelled B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Oh, pretty good.
Good. Carl, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. We completed Part 6, you talked about Louise Hinchcliffe started talking about the guides training sessions, and this would be for the river employees working on the river as a seasonal, well, sort of even trip-to-trip people that would be able to impart information about the park and the geology and the flora and the fauna to the passengers on the commercial river trips. And can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, today those trips are run as far as I know by the Grand Canyon River Guides, but at that time the Park Service I think was putting them together.
Okay.
And my impression anyway was that they were kind of the brainchild of Kim Crumbo.
Okay.
And at that time, that was when I was teaching my geology of the Grand Canyon class at Yavapai Community College up there at the canyon.
Okay.
And I'm not sure exactly how it all came about that Crumbo asked me to go along as a geology resource person, but he did.
Okay.
So I was that year I was doing the lower half, and so I got a real early start and headed down to Phantom Ranch, and because they had told me, I think they told me to be there at 8, and they showed up at like 10 or something like that.
Oh, okay. So you were there early for a while, but
yeah, I was there early. It was a beautiful, sunrise hike and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
And just hanging around on the boat beach, and then all of a sudden this, armada of rafts comes around the bend. And I had already I'd already done the class's geology field trip down to Phantom. Anyway, I'd been going back and forth to Phantom for a number of reasons, and I kind of knew the folks at the ranch. And so I had gotten down early enough that I could run up to the ranch, buy a case of beer, and then schlep it down to the river.
Okay.
And they were a little bit kind of like, be discreet about this because we're not licensed for off-site sales.
Ah.
So it's a little difficult to, kind of waddle through from the ranch down to the boat beach with a case of beer, but
being discreet. Yeah.
Yeah. So they all came around the bend, and let's see. I did kind of keep a record of that trip.
Neat.
And so looking through, it looks like we had six oar boats, two paddle boats, a 32-foot motor pontoon, and two kayaks.
Wow.
So it was, it was quite the armada coming through. And so we got everybody exchanged and loaded and all that kind of stuff and headed on downstream.
Now, this was 1983. Do you remember the date of the trip when you were there?
It was 1984.
Sorry, 1984.
And I met them on April 17th.
Okay. There was a lot of water coming out of the dam. I think they were doing, 30 to 40,000 constant?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
We can look it up.
This was only my second river trip.
Okay.
And so I wasn't really up on all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I do remember just in general my early river trips having to pay attention to the tides.
Okay.
On the river and getting, you know, getting stranded boats unstranded and that kind of stuff in the morning.
Yeah.
But I can't actually place particular incidents on particular trips.
Okay.
So
that was April 17th?
Yeah, that we did the changeover at Phantom.
Okay.
And
did a lot of people leave and a lot of people show up?
You know, I don't know. I know that, you know, I don't know if it was a complete changeover like they kind of do now, or whether it was just some or the others.
Mm. Okay.
And I know that Kim, when he talked to me about it, I thought I was going along to just kind of, you know, chat and give answers, you know, answer people's questions as we went down the river and that sort of thing.
Right.
And then I found out that really what he wanted was more formal talks.
Ooh.
And so for the whole rest of the trip, I was kind of scrambling a little bit to say, okay, let's see, what can I talk about today?
Mm.
And that sort of thing. And so on the subsequent trips, I was a little bit better prepared, but that one, it was kind of ad hoc. But he did have another guy that was doing geology, I don't remember his name. As I recall, he was doing work on the Precambrian, the metamorphics down at NAU, and he gave talks mostly about that.
Okay.
But wasn't nearly as knowledgeable about the Paleozoic rocks when we were in those stretches of the river.
Okay.
So let's see. We headed off, camped that night between Hermit and Boucher, a camp that I think we were at Travertine Canyon. I do remember that I eventually found a little spot of sand in the rocks that was big enough to hold my sleeping bag. It wasn't a massive beach or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So we sailed on down, camped there. And then the next day, let's see here. One other thing I should mention, both this river trip and also the backpacking trip that I did with my geology field trip or my geology class were both kind of revelatory for me. Hmm. I've been spending the whole spring, you know, doing all this research to teach my class, but I hadn't been out in the field at all. And so going down the Kaibab Trail and going down the river on this trip especially, I had all of this book learning that I'd picked up over the course of the semester, and I was just seeing the canyon with new eyes.
Oh wow!
It was, you know, just sort of a thing of, oh, that is fantastic. How could I have missed that?
Oh wow! Uh-huh.
Sorts of things. Probably the best example is coming down the Kaibab Trail as you're below tip off and going. There's a saddle that you kind of go through or go past just before you get to Panorama Point, just above the train wreck there. And in that saddle, there are these huge blocks. They're probably at least 6 feet cubed of Tapete sandstone, but they have these giant chunks of Shinumu quartzite embedded in the tapetes from where the rocks had fallen off the cliffs and then gotten buried in the river and beach sands of the Tapete sandstone.
Oh, neat.
And, you know, they're they're right there by the trail. You can see them from the trail if you look in the right direction.
Uh-huh.
But I'd certainly never noticed anything like that before.
Hmm. Wow.
And you know, just, and then to see these things and kind of, oh, wow. So it was a lot of that, you know, just going down the river was, oh, wow, look at that.
Oh, fun.
So it was a lot of fun. So this the second day, we went down to North Bass, or went down to the South Bass camp,
mm-hmm.
and then the next day went just a little ways up the North Bass, not over the saddle to Bass's camp on Shinnamon Creek, but just up a ways. Jan Balsam was along on that trip. That might have been when I first met her. I'm not sure. But anyway, she was long on the trip, and there were some ancestral Puebloan granaries up there.
Uh-huh.
Art Phillips was along from the Museum of Northern Arizona, and he was talking about the plants and that sort of thing. I think I may have talked about the supergroup some. Since it shows up so well looking upstream,
right.
You can see it wedging in under the tapetes as you look upstream from there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first learned about pack rat middens.
Oh, cool.
Which was kind of fun. So that was our second day. Third day, let's see. We went to Elk's Chasm, but we didn't hike up to the waterfalls or anything like that. But we had lunch just below Elves. There's a unnamed side stream that comes in down there.
Right.
And on the left. And while we were wandering around, we found this bighorn ram that had recently fallen to his death off the cliffs up above. It was kind of stormy weather, and I had my raincoat on, and I felt something brush against my raincoat, and I thought it was a bush. Turns out it's the only time in my life that a rattlesnake has actually almost connected with me.
Wow.
I hadn't noticed this Grand Canyon pink, and, you know, for as mellow as they are, apparently I got a little too close inside of his comfort zone, and the person behind me was kind of, oh, my God. So a little bit of an adrenaline rush there.
Yeah,
at lunch.
Huh. That's a beautiful little canyon, too.
It is a huge, huge arch in the, not freestanding, blind arch,
mm-hmm.
in the red wall up above it.
Mm.
And then the travertine and everything like that.
Yeah.
So it was very cool. That night we pushed on. We got all the way down to Deer Creek that night.
Okay.
I don't remember who I was riding with, but it was kind of a wild ride through Dubendorf.
Hmm.
Lulu Santa Maria.
Yep.
Who was, I believe she was, I'm not sure if she was still working. I don't think she was working for GCNHA, the Natural History Association, at the time, but she was our cook,
okay.
on that trip, and so she got us all, you know, fixed up with hot drinks as soon as we got down there, and we camped right across from Deer Creek Falls.
Okay,
not the big beaches, but a smaller beach directly across from the falls.
Yeah,
and then the next day there was a crew from the Western Archaeological Center. Park Service crew excavating a ancestral Puebloan site, and so we went up there and met with the archaeologist. Trinkle Jones was working up there, and they were talking about prehistory and all that kind of stuff, and how important pack rat nests were for helping to date things and establish paleoecology and that sort of thing. For when the folks were living there. And so on our way back down to the boats, we found a pack rat nest.
Cool.
And I was with Art Phillips, And, of course, being a botanist, he looked at it and goes, oh, this is an old one. And turned out it had juniper berries in it.
Cool.
I think it was, that indicated that it was more than 8,000 years old, at least the part of it that we were looking at.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that was a lot of fun.
Cool.
So,
what do you remember about Jan and Lulu and Trinkle?
Well,
and Art Phillips.
Yep. I remember Art, he was a very good speaker. You know, he knew, he was good at giving information at the right level.
Okay.
For the group that was there, but he had a obvious depth of knowledge beyond that. So he could talk about something, and then somebody would come up with a more detailed question, and he could handle it. He was also real good about giving us bigger picture sorts of things. I remember. A little bit further downstream, we were at Matt Katamiba, and the goldenrod that grows down there. He was talking about endangered plants, and at that time, that you could be threatened, you could be endangered, or you could be category 1, candidate species, category 1, 2, or 3, and then talking about how this goldenrod was a candidate species because it wasn't particularly threatened at this point, but like if they built the Bridge Canyon Dam, the entire world's population would have drowned.
Wow.
And so it was because the only known populations of them were under the proposed reservoir level.
Right.
And so he could, bring in stuff like this with larger implications and do a really good job of it.
Nice.
Trinkle was didn't really get to know Trinkle on that trip, but I worked with her extensively in my next job at Petrified Forest.
Okay,
because she was even though she worked in Tucson for WAC, the Western Archaeological Center, she was essentially our park archaeologist. If anything came up, I'd just get on the phone and ask Trinkle what to do.
Cool.
She was just a wonderful gal and very very pragmatic in terms of how to deal with things. She knew what the rules were, and she also had a practical way of meeting them. And so like I said, didn't really get to know her on that little encounter, but I did get to know her quite a bit working later at Petrified.
Okay.
And then Jan was along. I didn't chum around a lot with Jan, but I did talk to her, and she was just very much like Jan still is.
Mm-hmm.
Working. She hadn't been at Grand Canyon that long, of course, at that point, but she was already getting tied into figure out what was going on, and always had an opinion about pretty much anything, but it was always well reasoned.
Uh-huh.
And that's not to say I always agreed with her.
Uh-huh.
We could agree to disagree.
Uh-huh.
And very, very knowledgeable about those sorts of things.
Yeah. And then Lulu?
Lulu was a lot of fun.
Mm.
I really liked Lulu. It must have been my seasonal position. That's right. When I was working seasonally in the visitor center back in 1980-81, I remember we would help out over at NHA every now and then. Stocking things or whatever. And whenever a new publication came out, that's when they were first coming out with the little brochures on the individual trails.
Okay.
First editions of those. and we would always browbeat her into giving us copies of them.
Oh, cool.
You know, we need to have these. We talk to people about this. You should just donate them to us.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I can't do that. But eventually she would.
Right.
And just always a, basically when I think of Lulu, I think of her laughing.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
She was just fun to be around.
Cool. Okay, so that's the third day from Alice Chasm all the way down to Deer Creek, and then Trinkle visited her arc site. I'm assuming she was working in the Deer Creek Valley there.
She was, this was actually on the south side of the river.
Oh, okay.
It was that beach that we were camped on. It's not right at the mouth of a little side canyon, but there's a side canyon that comes in right at the foot of the Narrows, probably not even a quarter mile upstream from Deer Creek,
but uh-huh.
on river left.
Hmm.
And in the site that she was working on was up in the Tapetes, up that little side canyon.
Okay.
So yeah, I didn't. It wasn't until much later that I actually got up to the sites in Deer Creek.
Okay.
So
you know that's funny. It's pretty easy to get to Deer Creek from the rim. And thinking about the ancestral Pueblo and migration patterns going from place to place. But to get to those arc sites on river left in that area, there's a route through the Redwall at Spectre, and then you've got to go way downstream to find another route through the Redwall. And the question is, you know, how did they get there? Were they simply just crossing the river to use nice shelters and locations on that side of the river?
And that's one of the, in the reading I've done, it's kind of interesting where people will talk about, well, the river would have been an impassable barrier and it was a cultural divide and blah, blah, blah. And then somebody else will talk about, no, in the wintertime, you know, you could pretty much just wade across the river. There just wasn't that much water in it.
That's right. And the water in the fall would have been really warm and low, after the monsoons kind of died down. And, that you can certainly walk across the river up near Cataract at low water. So, you make that connection and go, all right.
Yeah. And it is a case of depending on what their subsistence pattern is, if they were like the Havasupai, where they were spending part of the year in the canyon and part of the year up on the rim,
mm-hmm.
then getting through the Redwall becomes an issue.
Right.
But if they were more centered on staying down inside of the canyon, that Redwall issue may not have been an issue.
That's right.
Hard to say.
Yeah, but there they were. So, we all scramble around and start looking at the Redwall real hard for routes, and they're in there. So
mm-hmm.
it just takes a while going downstream from there to make it work. So it's interesting.
Yep.
Okay, and then on downstream from there.
Yep, the next day, this would have been Saturday the 21st. We headed on down. I do have noted that I gave a little talk on the Surprise Valley slumps.
Oh, cool.
In through there. And then we had lunch down at Kanab Creek. Bluehead suckers were spawning.
Oh, wow.
And so they were just all over in the creek. And various people hiked different distances up and down the creek. I didn't make a note of where we camped that night, but I think we camped at Ledges. So, I do remember. I don't remember which trip it was on. but I do remember stopping at what they now call Paradise Canyon,
mm-hmm.
Which at the time Crumbo insisted on referring to as slime.
Yeah, Slimy Tick Canyon or Jack's Canyon or Paradise Canyon. Little spring in it. Dribbles over the Muav ledges and drops into the river there.
Yeah, and I know on one trip we climbed up the ledges to a pool up above at the spring. And that was, we were all just impressed with how gorgeous it was. And it's like, why would you call this slime? And Crumbo was, I want to call it slime because I don't want people stopping here.
Right.
So, but I don't remember if it was that trip or some other trip that I actually got up there. I'm pretty sure that we camped at ledges that night. And then the next day went down to Havasu and did a little talk down there. And one of the things I always like to point out at Havasu is down at the lower end of the limestone ramp where the motor rigs always tie up, and the notches that their sandy ropes have gradually abraded into the limestone.
Yeah.
And I always like to point that out to people. It's kind of like, okay, so, we talk about how erosion happens, and here's some stuff that's just happened over the course of a couple of decades.
Right.
Unintentional rubbing. So, these rocks do wear away.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, at Havasu, I didn't go very far up that time. I had smashed my finger, crushing cans.
Ooh.
Bad aim. And it wasn't really that bad of an injury. But at the same time, I didn't want to be swooshing it around in the water coming down Havasu Creek either.
Right, good thinking.
So I just kind of took it easy there at Havasu, and then while folks again hiked to different distances up and down the canyon,
mm-hmm.
and we had a guy along. I'm not sure. When, let's see, yeah, we stopped, also stopped at Matt Cat and had some talks there. That's when Art talked about the goldenrod.
Okay.
And that sort of thing. Do-do-do-do-do. Just checking my notes here. That was something. We got down to Fern Glen, and that was just shortly after the Surprise Canyon formation was really hitting the news, so to speak.
Okay.
And so it was kind of tricky. It's actually easier to see from National Canyon, but there is a nice outcrop of Surprise Canyon, which was news to a lot of folks.
Okay.
Seeing that dark red stuff up there.
At the top of the limestone. So you kind of crane your neck and look way up there and try to go, I guess that's it.
Yep. So, camped at Fern Glen, and then the next day, gosh, boop, 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 the next day we ran Lava Falls.
Yep.
And that's pretty much all I wrote about for that day.
So. Okay.
We camped that night at 192 on the Hurricane Fault, and just talked about the lava going down. One thing I didn't know about at that time, 192 is just that whole area there has some great flood deposits, which I later learned about. So would have been great if I'd known about them then to talk about them, but mm-hmm. I was still learning geology. So.
And these are flood deposits from lava dam failures, is that right?
Right. Okay. Right. They're a lot of really, really coarse river tumbled rocks up on top of the Chapits. So a good, 50 to 100 feet above river level, there's this thick deposit. And then there's also just big slabs, scores of feet on the side of lava flows that got washed in down there too. Hmm. And you get a little bit below the canyon, below 192, and look back upstream, and you can actually see how the bottom of the canyon has been filled in by all of these outburst deposits, and then the river has carved a new course through them,
right.
maybe 50 feet deep or so, but carved a new course kind of meandering through these outburst flood deposits.
Hmm.
So when you're going through them, they don't look that impressive, but if you get just the right, you get the right vista points,
right.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yes. Cool.
So yeah, that was, and then the next day we headed on down, and it was, not too many stops. It was so often what happens is you run lava and then you just head for Diamond Creek,
right?
And we did we stopped at Pumpkin Spring and that kind of stuff, but for the most part we're just booking on down. I don't remember where we camped, but it wasn't far above Diamond Creek.
Okay.
That night, and then took out a diamond the following day. So it was that trip. It was not since I wasn't as prepared to do interp along the way. It was kind of frantic for me trying to come up with stuff. And I was also feeling a little bit insecure because there were other geologists along, like the guy from NAU. And it's like, well, I don't want to be making a mistake in front of all these other folks.
Right.
And but on that trip, I learned that, okay, yeah, they all have their specialties. And, there are some geologists who can talk about anything in the Grand Canyon with authority, folks like Stan Buse or Ivo Lukita or people like that. But then there are a lot of people who only know their one little area of specialty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that gave me a lot more confidence in terms of being able to talk geology.
Yeah.
Be right up front and say, okay, I don't have a degree. I've only taken a couple of classes in college, but.
Right.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's about having a breadth of the knowledge. Depth of the knowledge, and being able to impart that, whether you got a certificate mm-hmm. or not.
Yeah, yeah, and it's something I did eventually learn, but it took a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, it's practice. Interesting, and I'm assuming that, well, again, on the commercial world, most of the river trips, passengers are leaving at Whitmore Wash, the helipad there. And a mm-hmm. lot of trips took out at Diamond Creek then. But the canyon keeps going below there, and there's some really neat geology happening downstream from there.
Yeah, it was actually a long time. It was, oh gosh, when did we do that trip? It's around 2003 or something like that. Before I ever got below Diamond Creek.
Oh wow! Okay.
So it was, it was always one of those. I'd always look at Diamond Creek Rapid, and think, what's on the other side of that rock?
Right. What's down there around the corner?
Yeah, and we on that first trip, we actually did. I almost got my chance on that first GTS trip. because the paddle boat took out. They touched shore. About half the folks got out, and then the current caught them and pulled them back into the river again. Okay. With only half strength.
Ah.
And we thought they were going to go around the corner and on down through the rapid, but
paddle hard.
with their paddling, and then we formed a human chain reaching out into the river, and we snagged them just in time.
Oh wow!
It was they actually quit de-rigging one of the oar boats just just in case.
Yeah.
Needed to follow them on down to Pierce.
Right. And there would have been much demand for that. Oh, we got to go.
Yeah.
Fun. And that was 1984. Okay.
Right. And not sure actually whether I did a trip in 85 or not, but I did do another GTS trip in 86. And that was actually my first trip down the upper half.
Oh, okay.
So, and that one, again, was a GTS trip. Mary Lois. Oh, but before I get away from that, I think on our previous interview, I said that I didn't remember if there were any kayaks, but there were a couple of kayaks on that first trip.
And who was paddling them? Do you remember?
No, I don't. Didn't make a note of that.
Okay.
I do remember that one guy got ejected in Lava Falls, so that was kind of exciting.
Okay.
Fished him out. No big problems or anything like that.
Right.
But it's always exciting.
Yeah. When you don't have a good roll, you will eventually get one. Practice. So cool. So the next GTS, 1986, just when you got a kind of a good handle on the geology in the lower half, now you got to do the upper half where the geology is just a little different.
And just for intimidation, a couple of the people that I mentioned before, Stan Buse and Ivo Lukita were on that trip.
Wow. Stan Buse, B-U-E-S-S, how do you spell his last name?
B-E-U-S-S.
B-E-U-S-S. And Ivo, how do you spell Ivo's last name?
L-U-C-C-H-I-T-A.
Thank you. And those two guys are sort of the foremost authorities. Well, there's a handful of foremost authorities of Grand Canyon geology. People have studied it, you know, like George Billingsley as well, sort of in that group. And my gosh, how did you handle that?
Well, it was one of those where I listened a lot.
Okay.
But the other thing I did was more because I was in an interp job. I talked more about how to talk to tourists about geology.
Okay.
You know, I did a talk. The geology talk that I gave up on the rim. What I would try and do is talk about how what we have in the canyon relates to other places, whether it's by similarity or contrast or whatever. So you could say, like when the Supai was being deposited. The Appalachians were monster mountains with these rainforests growing on the slopes of them or whatever, and say, you know, is anybody here from Pennsylvania? And at that time, we didn't have the erosional debris from those Appalachians that had been discovered in the Supai and the other Paleozoic rocks. We hadn't found those yet, but still, it was something so I could relate what they were seeing to something that they might be familiar with at home. So I could do that. I remember one talk that I gave on the little bitty beach on River Left, just above Grapevine. I gave a talk where I was talking about how to make different kinds of rocks, and what I would do is say, okay, you know, imagine you've got a black bag, and we're going to make rocks inside this thing. So, and I could do the whole schmear, but basically I say, okay, to make a sandstone, take our black bag, and we're going to fill it up with marbles, because marbles are like sand grains. They're kind of rounded, but, you know, sand grains are too small to watch real closely, so we'll use these marbles. We'll fill up our bag, shake the bag a little bit to settle all the marbles down, dump a bunch of cement in there, and then let the cement set up, and then turn our black bag upside down, and what do we have? Well, we have a solid block of marbles, because the marbles don't sit against each other nice and tight. There's space in there for the cement to get in, and so it's well cemented together, so the rock is hard, and that's why sandstone is hard. And I talk about the different kinds of cement that go into the rock and glue it together and
cool.
And that kind of stuff. And then I do that for mudstones and for limestones, and that was just a huge hit with people. They just, oh, that's fabulous. I'm going to use that all the time. And,
cool, yeah. Yeah.
So I would concentrate on trying to do things like that. I do remember there was, of course, Stan Buse, being a geology professor at NAU, he'd had a lot of his graduate students coming up to the canyon for their thesis, exploring different rock layers. And one of them had written his thesis on the Toro Weep formation. And the Toro Weep in the upper part of the Toro Weep, the Woods Ranch member, you get this interfingering of gypsum that was evaporated, you know, just a type of salt,
mm-hmm.
Gypsum that had formed from seawater evaporating along the shoreline, and sandstone from the beach adjacent to the shoreline.
Hmm.
And they would interfinger with each other as sea level made these minor adjustments. Well, gypsum dissolves in water, but water can't flow through it. It's the water can eventually dissolve away the gypsum, but it can't percolate through it. It has to dissolve it on the surface. Sandstone doesn't dissolve, but water can flow through the pore spaces. And so there's this zone where the gypsum and the sandstone interfinger with each other, and that really helps dissolve away the gypsum, because the water can flow through the sandstone, dissolve away the gypsum, and so you get this collapse from this enhanced dissolving of the gypsum. And that shoreline, that interfingering, kind of lines up with Marble Canyon. Well, the guy who had written this thesis had suggested that that's why Marble Canyon is where it is that there'd been this collapse as the gypsum dissolved away, which formed kind of a natural trench that the Colorado River was able to capitalize on and establish the course of Marble Canyon. And so I said something to Stan about it, because it was his graduate student. And he obviously didn't buy that hypothesis. Well, that was just his idea, and it's just an idea. I wouldn't even call it a hypothesis.
Oh, interesting.
It was kind of fun. Later on, we were downstream doing the Carbon Canyon Lava Chuar loop.
Yep.
And we got up there into the Glaros Formation on the west side of the Butte Fault, and he was drawing a mental blank and pulls me aside and, which formation is this again?
Oh, cool.
So that was kind of fun. Flip side of it was that we got down to Evo had joined us. I believe he'd hiked down Saltwater Wash.
Okay.
And joined us there by the Brown inscription. And he'd been kind of hinting at talking about his master theory for the origin of the course of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon, which is something that I'd been reading his different papers about, but still had, I was still having some trouble piecing some little bits and pieces together. Mm. And so he was going to do his, I guess you call it his capstone talk on the origin of the Colorado River in Redwall Cavern. And so we got down to Redwall, and my boatman missed the eddy.
Oh, no.
Pull as he might, and he really tried, but I missed the lecture. And to add insult to injury, you know, we drifted on downstream and pulled into the next little gully coming in on River Right, so we could wait for the rest of the group to catch up with us, maybe a quarter mile downstream. And so we tied up there and said, well, let's look around here. And so we explored around a little bit and found some very cool beds in the Redwall limestone, maybe 6 or 8 inches thick, that were completely composed of little crinoid stems.
Oh, wow. Neat.
So that was really fun. But we got back down to the boat and discovered that we tied up against a chunk of carnivorous limestone.
Ooh.
And the front compartment of the raft was completely deflated.
Oh, wow.
So that
boatman was having a hard day. Oh, my gosh.
He really did. Yeah, it was not his best day. And so we used a bunch of straps and everything to tie up the front of the raft so that we could move downstream with some semblance of control until camp that night when we fixed it. So not his best day, but later on the trip, I did get to talk to Evo and get a lot of my questions answered anyway. And,
cool.
Yeah, he was actually, I was asking him questions, and he was expecting me to not be as familiar with the geography of the canyon. And so when he found out that not only did I know where a bunch of these places were, whether it was, Hidden Canyon and jump up out in the Grand Wash Cliffs or whatever, that I not only knew about them, but I'd been there. Then he really opened up.
Nice.
That worked out, pretty well.
Cool.
But it was a fun trip because it was new for me. And, but yet once again, I'd known about stuff. so I kind of knew what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mary Lois Shriver. She was a mule wrangler. She'd actually taken my geology class, and she was the one that got us a cabin dirt cheap at Phantom Ranch when the first time I taught the class, when we did our field trip down there. She'd hired on as cook for the trip, and then was also on the side doing haircuts because she ran the beauty salon up in the Bright Angel Lodge at that time.
Right.
Doing haircuts on the side in the evenings for the boatman. And we were at Nankoweap, and I had, they decided not to go up to the granaries because everybody'd been up there, and there wasn't, for whatever reason, it wasn't going to time out right, and nobody was particularly disappointed about not going up there because they were all boatmen, except for me.
Mm.
And Mary Lois said, well, get up early tomorrow morning, and while I'm fixing breakfast, you'll have enough time to run up there and run back down. And so that's literally what I did, was I got up early, waved at her as she was getting the coffee started, and ran up to the granaries, took a couple pictures, and ran back down again.
Cool.
And it all worked out fine.
Yeah.
So.
Nice. And so that was 86.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to leave Grand Canyon later in the year.
Right.
Were you thinking about leaving at that time? How did that come about?
By that time, I was pretty sick of working in TERP.
Okay.
It was a case of, we pretty much ran frontline interpretation 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so I was getting pretty well burned out. That particular trip was one where I took out at Diamond Creek in the morning, and that afternoon I had the closing shift at the museum.
Oh, wow. That's a long day.
Yeah, it was a long day, and it, you know, when you come off the river, you're really not in the mood.
Well, you got to deal with the altitude as well. Let's say, you know, you're suddenly at 7,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
and you've been at 2,000. And
it's cold up there.
It's cold, and you don't have the oxygen in your blood. You know, it's like nap time. So
Yeah. So I had already pretty much decided that if I couldn't come up with a different job, I was going to resign and go back to school and probably get a degree in geology.
Okay.
But at the same time, I was subject to furlough, and so that meant that every year I had a month off. And oddly enough, you'd think it wouldn't be, but lots of times my furlough was in the summertime, because that's when we had seasonals on board who could cover the furlough.
Makes sense.
And so by that time, the research over at Petrified Forest was really, really booming, the paleontology and the archaeology.
Wow.
And so my other plan was my preferred alternative, rather than quitting the Park Service altogether, my preferred alternative had been to get a job in resource management.
Okay.
And so I had a couple of irons in the fire that way. One of them was the Park Service was doing what they called the Resource Management Intake Program, and it was kind of a response to the professionalization of law enforcement that was going on at that time. It was for resource managers, and it was I think it was like a 6-month program.
Hmm.
But I had applied for that, and it was one where they would send you, you'd rotate around to a bunch of different parks working in resource management, and interspersed with that, you would be taking classes on different aspects of resource management at different universities.
Oh, wow.
And so I had applied for that, and then I had also been visiting my girlfriend over at Petrified Forest on the weekends and on my furloughs, and so I'd go over and visit Lori, and sometimes she'd come up to the canyon and visit me, but when I was over at Petrified Forest visiting her, I would go out and work with some of the researchers on different projects and that kind of stuff that was going on.
Oh, cool.
And
like what?
Going out on rock art surveys or fossil surveys.
Okay.
Prospecting. Sometimes in the park, I remember one time Sid Ash, the paleobotanist,
right,
was going to go down to St. John's over in eastern Arizona because he knew of a good collecting locality over there. It was on land that was owned by the Catholic Church in St. John's. And so he would do research over there. And actually, that's where I got some really nice specimens, where not very many, but a couple,
uh-huh,
of plant fossils that were very, very common plant fossils. We found them, but he says, I don't need these. And I said, well, can I take them? And he goes, well, sure. Yeah, the church doesn't care.
Oh, that's cool.
So I had some nice specimens that I could then hand around when I was teaching classes.
Yeah.
And I was kind of campaigning for a resource management job at Petrified Forest. I was applying for a resource intake program. That fall, I had been in the, I got into Ranger Skills, which was back in those days a 6-week class at Albright Training Center, and which was just kind of an overview of being a ranger you know, we would have sessions on law enforcement. We'd have sessions on interpretation and really in-depth training on different things. It's folks that were selected from all over the country that would come. And I remember, you know, for some of them, especially from the Eastern Historical Parks, it was actually their first time that they'd ever been in one of these iconic Western national parks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And on that, in Ranger Skills, I was actually leading. They would do a 3-day backpacking trip, and there were different classes. One of them went down and spent 2 nights at Phantom. One of them did Phantom Indian Gardens. And then one class went east and one class went west on the Hermit Loop. And I would lead the Hermit Loop hike. So I was taking the Ranger Skills class, and that was right when they were making the selections for this resource management intake program. And so being at Albright, the folks were, the staff at Albright were in touch with whoever it was that was making the selections. And they were giving us updates on who was still in and who was still out.
Oh, gosh.
There were several people in the class that had applied for it. And I was the last one in the class to not get in.
Oh, gee.
So none of us got in, but it was kind of high drama. And then, but also finally that fall, the old resource manager at Petrified Forest had retired. And so I applied and got the position. And so I wound up not resigning from the Park Service, but instead going to work at Petrified Forest as a resource management specialist.
And that's, it's funny because you didn't get into the course, which would have really helped you skill-wise for that job.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are with the job, which is good to have the job, no doubt, because it's going to get you out of interp. But, well, my gosh, I'm just like, I can see a crash course in resource management coming up.
Yeah, it was. And and Petrified Forest was you know, in spite of all the research that was happening there and all the interest in the staff, it was still, for the most part, a one-man show. When my phone rang, I never knew what it was going to be, whether it was going to be, you know, archaeology, paleontology, wildlife, you know, whatever. I was it.
Wow. That can be fun in a way. You can learn an awful lot about a lot of different things.
Well, and I did. And my boss at that time, Chris Andrus, was chief ranger, and I worked for him. And he was just amazing. I think I mentioned, you know, the researchers coming back to Petrified Forest and finding stuff and realizing that, oh wow, there's good work to be done here. But Chris and then Chris was the one that really made it happen. He was the one that, yeah, this is really cool. You know, how can I facilitate this?
Oh wow, that's neat.
And so he was the one. The superintendent at the time, Roger Rector, was also very much involved with it. But he was a superintendent. He had a lot of other stuff going on.
Right.
And so Chris was the one that knew enough about how to make things happen with the Park Service that he could make things happen. And he also really, I think, was instrumental in getting the rest of the staff involved. Getting folks out, helping the different scientists on their field work, communicating just how interesting this was all becoming and that kind of stuff. So he you know, the science was exploding, but he was just pushing it along the whole way, and it really helped out a lot.
Cool. I mean, just having support from staff above you or lateral is just so helpful, I would think.
Yeah, it was. And so I came on board. It was kind of,
and this is like, you know, like Christmas Eve in 1986.
Pretty much. I don't think I went to work. I think that the moving company literally unloaded my stuff on Christmas Eve.
Mm.
So it was like around New Year's or something when I finally went to work. But there was nobody else there. I had like a week to just get moved into my office and see what all was there and that kind of stuff. It was kind of a weird entry on duty.
Well, that's nice. At least it was quiet.
Yeah, it was quiet. I could figure out, you know, what was going on and that kind of stuff, and get a lot of the paperwork and the domestic stuff kind of taken care of before I had to dive into the job.
And did you move in with Lori?
No.
Okay.
No, I actually had a 3-bedroom house.
Oh, wow.
I probably could have fit into a 1-bedroom apartment, but there weren't any available at the time. So I had a 3-bedroom house, and I promised not to use one of the bedrooms, and that gave me a deduction on my rent.
Ah, good.
But the whole thing was pretty empty. I actually had a big inflatable stegosaurus in my living room, just to kind of take up space.
Oh, gosh. You know, Carl, we've been going for probably a little over an hour here, and maybe this is a good place to wrap this part up, because we'll have a lot to learn about resource management there at Petrified. And so this will sort of wrap up this time period of Grand Canyon. Is there anything else you want to bring into this about Grand Canyon 85-86 before we wrap this up?
About the only other thing that is kind of a bridge between the two positions is that at Grand Canyon, at Albright actually, at that time it was, I think, easier than it is today for Grand Canyon residents to audit classes at Albright.
Oh.
And you know, we wouldn't get a desk or anything like that, but they didn't mind if we just came and sat quietly in the back of the room.
Nice.
And so besides going over to Petrified Forest and visiting Lori and getting out in the field and teaching my geology classes and all that kind of stuff, when there were resource management courses offered at Albright, I would go in and audit as much of them as I could.
Nice.
And so that was, you know, there were a few, like there was an air quality class that I went in and audited that I had no idea would be so important to me later on in my career. But that was something else that I had been doing to kind of learn more, pad my resume, however you want to look at it. And it was really valuable, and helped keep my eyes on the prize in terms of trying to keep some sort of a Park Service career going.
Yeah, nice.
So.
And that gave you a little more exposure to resource management. Yeah.
Right.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, we will conclude Part 7 of Oral History Interview with Carl Bowman. Today is Saturday, November 21, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Carl, thank you so very much.
Sure, thank you.